B-Pod Studios.
Mike Riley, welcome back. My thoughts and prayers have been with you and your family the last few weeks. I can't express to you what the loss of your father has been like. To open the show this week, the forum is yours to open.
Thank you, Jimmy. Appreciate it. And thanks to all the listeners and everyone that reached out to express their condolences to my family and I. I'd never, ever, on my worst enemy, would ever wish for them to lose a loved one, let alone a parent. And it was one of the hardest things, the hardest day of my life, saying goodbye to my dad. But I can tell you that, you know, he passed away with all of us around his bedside, and that's what he wanted. That's the most peaceful thing I can look at from that spectrum, and that's what he wanted. But you know what? This is a good form for me here to be back with you, Jimmy, and get back into the swing of things. My dad would want. He would want that. He'd want more normalcy and so forth. So it's a tough couple of weeks roller coaster ride, and that's obviously why I wasn't here last week after his passing. And, you know, he was in the hospital 2 weeks ago. Also, we didn't do a show that week. So I do appreciate the kind words, everyone reaching out and so forth that did catch wind of it. And appreciate you, Jimmy, letting me express my appreciation and thanks to everyone and for your support as well during this as well. I know you were checking in on me a lot of the time, making sure I was good and trying to send some positive vibes. And you know what? If anyone ever has to go through that, you know, something as small as what Jimmy was doing for me as a friend, helping out, checking in, just always checking on people. It goes a long way. You don't know, you don't realize, but it goes a long way. So I appreciate it, Jimmy, and let's rock and roll. Let's talk some wrestling here. You ready?
And then today I sent you a text message that said, I got 30 pages of notes on The Undertaker. Let's go.
That's right. Game on, baby.
This week, we're going to profile The Undertaker, and we're going to do a long-form show on one topic, and that is The Undertaker, who is Mike Riley's favorite wrestler. And I felt like, whereas he has essentially retired without saying the words retired, we should dedicate this in a long form thing. So this episode is about Mark Calloway, known as The Undertaker. It's a 30-year career. Yeah. So we're going to point out highlights that kind of stuck out to us in as best a timeline form as we can. There will be different sound bites and promos and finishes or starts of matches worked into the show this week. But let's start off with the beginning. And Mike, I first noticed Mark Calloway as a member of the Skyscrapers. He was teaming with Dan Spivey. He broke off into a single. Spivey left WCW. The first featured single match I saw Mean Mark Calloway was WCW Capital Combat 90, Return of RoboCop. He beat Johnny Ace with a heart punch, which was his finisher for him, but he didn't finish him there. He hit him with the heart punch and then went to the top rope, walked halfway down the ropes, and dropped an elbow, which WCW had a sponsor for. It was called the Slam-O-Meter, and it was an 8.3. So this pay-per-view, he's managed by Teddy Long. The next pay-per-view, he's challenging Lex Luger for the United States Championship. He's managed by Paulie Dangerously, who we know today as Paul Heyman. So Mean Mark loses to Luger following a little bit of chaos and a clothesline, which is the second time in as many profile TV matches that Lex Luger won a match against a bigger guy with a clothesline. Now fast forward a few months, and he's on WWF TV as The Undertaker, managed by Brother Love.
Everybody's got a price for the $1 million man. So without further ado, I will introduce to you now my mystery partner, led to the ring by his manager, Brother Love, weighing in at 320 pounds from Death Valley. I give you The Undertaker.
The Undertaker, the mystery partner, is now revealed.
I never heard of
him. He just got nailed with a tombstone.
What is it?
I think it's a tombstone, and it's over. It's over for that guy.
It sure was a tombstone.
Holy cow.
So, Mike Riley, when did you first discover Mean Mark, or did you discover him as The Undertaker at that Survivor Series in 1990?
Yeah, actually, after the Survivor Series in 1990, it was more 1991 for me with The Undertaker. And I always say my most vivid depiction of pro wrestling is when Jake the Snake Roberts had his snake and it bit the Macho Man Randy Savage. And that, of course, led up to Jake being suspended at Survivor Series 1991. And it was all during that time where Ric Flair came in and he brought the NWA gold belt, the WCW World Heavyweight title. But what was so vivid to me on that particular Superstars right in that time frame there was The Undertaker in the funeral parlor. And it was actually Paul Bearer in the funeral parlor with Hulk Hogan. And Hulk Hogan, who, of course, you know, that's where I really got into the whole pro wrestling spectrum there. And everyone knew Hulk Hogan. You saw him in the supermarkets and the toy stores, his dolls, everything. We know the pop culture icon he was. So it's like, wow, there's Hulk Hogan. And all of a sudden, he's on the microphone there, and Paul Bearer is talking to him. Undertaker comes out of the casket from behind, and he whacks him. He just whacks him right down there with the steel chair, which then set up their eventual Survivor Series 1991 match. So it's right in that time frame there. The fall of 1991, about a year after his official debut into the WWF. Did I go back in time to look at his career there? And then obviously for the WCW days a little bit too? Yes, but that's my real first depiction of the greatest, The Undertaker, right there in 1991.
We'll go to that Survivor Series moment. It's the Undertaker against Hulk Hogan for the WWF Championship, and The Undertaker wins. He beats Hulk Hogan for the WWF Championship in what they touted as the gravest challenge. And it's a match we've talked about in a featured match of the week. But in short form, I think it's safe to say we were both shocked that Taker won the title.
Yeah.
And then he loses it back in a few days.
Yeah. 5 days later. And there it is, just to get it off of the Hulkster. And then, of course, the Jack Tunney scenario there, which then I think you and I agree led up to the greatest Royal Rumble of all time, 1992, that vacant Royal Rumble there, because they had to strip the title. And he didn't have a winner there. So it was perfect storyline telling the whole way. But it was a surprise, though, the fact that he beat Hulk Hogan a year into his tenure into the WWF. And, you know, I think we touched on this about a month ago on that particular episode of The Last Ride, the documentary series on the WWE Network. And The Undertaker made mention or did he make mention on there or was somewhere else? Maybe it's another interview about Hulk Hogan, where Hogan was nervous about him, you know, he taking the tombstone there at Survivor Series 1991. And that was like, okay, he didn't want to put him over, and then he goes back and wins the title on that. So there's a lot of backstory on that. And the match was a dud. The Tuesday in Texas one also a dud. But a historical moment there for The Undertaker at such a young age. You beat Hulk Hogan, a guy who had, you know, revolutionized, really revamped pro wrestling. And that's a huge moment for him right there in his career.
So from listening to the different interviews over the past years, it feels like Undertaker only won the WWF title because WWE had this idea of a bounce back pay-per-view concept. So the Survivor Series has a controversial finish. So we'll see if WWF fans will buy the return match in 6 days. And Hulk Hogan regains the WWF championship in about as much of a pig bleep of a match as you'll ever see. Hogan wins the match with a roll-up after he throws The Undertaker's ashes into his face. Both the Survivor Series match and the Tuesday in Texas match were voted worst matches of the show by the readers of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. And I mention this because Meltzer in 1991 wrote in his newsletter the success of the bounce back pay-per-view. And it was a good buy rate. It drew money. But I remember I didn't see the match until it popped up on WWE Network all these years later because
really
I wasn't going. So backstory.
Yeah.
My aunt's favorite wrestler was The Undertaker.
Okay. Good aunt.
And so, we used to go to my grandmother's house because my grandmother and my aunt lived together and we would watch all the wrestling shows.
Yep.
So going from Newton to Brookline on a Tuesday night on a school night wasn't in the cards.
No, it makes sense.
They do it once a month for Sundays and then later on twice a month for Sundays when it was WWF and WCW, but it wasn't Tuesday middle of the week. We're taking you out on a school night. That just wasn't going to happen.
Let alone right after Thanksgiving.
Exactly. So I remember I wanted to because I'm like, oh, Hulk's going to win the title back. Like I knew this,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But it was a controversial finish, which makes me think that The Undertaker only got the title because they had this grander concept idea.
And, right.
And to further that point, Taker in the 92 Rumble, kind of meaningless appearance.
Yeah, did nothing.
He got a bat. So the stipulation was because Hogan and Taker were former champions, they could only select numbers 20 through 30. Taker got 20 and was eliminated within seconds of Hulk Hogan hitting the ring.
Yep.
So that feels to me like a waste. And that was the 92 Royal Rumble, which was for the WWF Championship. Ric Flair goes on to win that Rumble and the WWF title. So Undertaker goes from champion, beating Hulk Hogan, losing to Hulk Hogan, getting eliminated by Hulk Hogan, to a WrestleMania 8 match with Jake the Snake Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
Which looks really good on paper until you find out, well, it's Jake's last match. And Jake Roberts tells The Undertaker, no, tombstone me on the floor. And then Undertaker gets in trouble because Jake Roberts, the veteran who he's supposed to trust, changes the finish of the match.
Yep.
So, but Undertaker, Jake Roberts, had Jake hung around, it would have been a longer and a deeper program, mm-hmm. I assume, because Jake would later go on to WCW, and he got porked over. Because he was promised one deal and then Bill Watts came in and gave him a different deal. But back to The Undertaker. Undertaker beats Jake Roberts. And okay, now we've got something here. Mm-hmm. Now we've got something. Maybe there's some momentum to be built there.
Yeah. It just 6 minutes, 36 seconds, WrestleMania 8. And, you know, The Undertaker was a face. He was a face there. And that was a, looking back at that match, the WrestleMania 8 match, I saw it over the last few days to watch it again. He wasn't really, the crowd wasn't really 100% over with him too. Like they, you know, he was not, you hear the bell gong and the crowd goes crazy now. They weren't into that yet. This was his real first match to the fans as a face, whether you wanted to be told it or not. And that was the way how he turned on Jake. Or he didn't turn on Jake. I'm sorry. He saved the Macho Man when Jake was going back out there to go after Savage. I think
Saturday Night's main event where Jake Roberts loses.
Yep.
And he gets to the back dressing room, and Jake Roberts is going to hit Elizabeth with a chair. And the Undertaker steps in and saves the day. And that led to their WrestleMania 8 match.
And that made him a face. So, you know, again, with a name and the character as the Taker, and less than six months ago, beats Hulk Hogan for the title. Huge. That's a huge thing as a villain. And now to be told that he's a face, you got to get that crowd over there. And I you had something going there with Jake. He was on his way to the WCW, his last match there at WrestleMania 8. And it just didn't do much after. Like, okay, so where are we going with The Undertaker? Are we going to make him a champion again? Are we gonna, I mean, yeah, we can make him the baby face here, but that's such a promising character and a evil the scenario he had before, the funeral parlor, all of that stuff, to go in your favor as a bad guy. Now you want everyone to believe that he is a face, which eventually did turn to a very good baby face for many years in the WWF.
All right, here at WrestleMania 7, ladies and gentlemen, it's Superstars and Stripes Forever. Joining me now, a superstar who makes his living on the fact that nothing, absolutely nothing, lasts forever. I'm talking, of course, about The Undertaker, along with his manager, Paul Bearer. Hey, what do you say, guys? How about this celebration we're having here today, huh? Isn't it great? A great day to be alive, wouldn't you say? This guy must be tall. I'm 6'3". I can't get over it. Now, what are you doing with that measuring tape? Huh?
38.
Oh, come on now. Look, you don't have to take any measurements. I know we're all getting older, but...
33.
Hey, you know, these guys are serious, aren't you? I think he's serious. Oh, boy. Listen, we're...
27.
But this is a live show. We're dying out here. We really should talk a little bit about, you know, your urn and who's in it and what's going on here. I played some dead rooms before.
Come on, this Wednesday night, the Survivor Series, the coffin match.
Kamala, you will not survive Survivor Series. Kamala, rest in peace.
So here's kind of what I find interesting is that Taker wins the title November 27th, 1991. Taker doesn't win the WWF title again until March 23rd of 1997 at WrestleMania 13.
Yep.
Now, in between there, he had programs with Yokozuna and Bret Hart. He had the Undertaker versus Undertaker program. And he had a program with the Warrior. And he had the Million Dollar Corporation, and he finally, I think that, because the Yoko program was just to get Yokozuna over,
right?
The Bret Hart thing, he wasn't really going to win the title with Bret Hart. The Million Dollar Corporation was kind of like, eh. We all remember Giant Gonzalez, which he holds against everybody in that company for having to work with him.
Oh, yeah.
But I think that the Undertaker really, really got back into an in-depth program with the debut of Mankind, Mick Foley.
Yep.
And that was when you had a real threat to the Undertaker. And that was Yoko was a threat too, but he was the champion and they were setting Yoko up for different things. And
right.
I think Undertaker had some issues going on. So you couldn't really dig in and really, The Undertaker was more of like a special attraction, especially with Undertaker versus Undertaker, right?
Right.
But I think Mankind debuting and beating Taker at King of the Ring 96, and you had the finish of Paul Bearer accidentally, those are my quotation fingers, hitting Undertaker in the back of the head with the urn, leading to Mankind putting the mandible claw on him and beating the Undertaker, and the shock of Vince and JR and Owen Hart, who was on commentary at the time, put the question out there. Did Paul Bearer do it on purpose? Does he see more in Mankind? And then you go to SummerSlam with the Boiler Room Brawl.
Oh, yeah.
And the Paul Bearer turn, which gave the Undertaker a little extra. And then what I think is one of the better pay-per-views of that time is the 96 Survivor Series. Mm-hmm. And Undertaker finally beating Mankind in a higher profile spot, and then it's all systems go forward for the Undertaker. Yeah. So Mike, lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
The Mankind story, is there anything in that gap of time that you really want to highlight and comment on?
Yeah. I mean, that Boiler Room Brawl, SummerSlam 96, and also Mankind's debut. It was the night after WrestleMania 12, where The Undertaker had he had a pretty decent feud there with Diesel, and just two giants going at it there at WrestleMania 12. And Mankind comes to Monday Night Raw the night after and, you know, gets the mandible claw on The Undertaker. I was a WWF guy. I didn't watch ECW, hardcore WCW as much before. I had no idea about Mick Foley. No idea. No idea who his whole backstory was on this, but he was just told to us as Mankind. And I'm like, who is this freak, you know, coming out here, pulling his hair out, mandible claw. You're right. That was a serious threat to the Taker after taking down Diesel, going through the likes of all the other guys that he had been put up against. And again, during that time period where WWF was so down in the dumps, almost, you know, in a serious scenario, I wouldn't say of close to shutting down, but really reconfiguring their whole business spectrum of things. So Mankind right there, night after Mania 12, and then the Boiler Room Brawl, SummerSlam 96. You talk about that. One of the biggest shocks of my lifetime in pro wrestling, Paul Bearer turning on The Undertaker. Just couldn't believe that right there. And just, it was so much of a feud because it set up, it had the Buried Alive match after that, a couple of months after that. Foley and The Undertaker still going at it, even after Undertaker won the title. I know we'll talk about that in a little bit. At WrestleMania 13, he fought Mankind the month after. And you know, you would get him again. But Mick Foley did say in the Last Ride documentary, the final episode, that if it weren't for The Undertaker, Mick Foley would not be where he is today. So he's the kind of guy that revamped him. He had so many moments with him, so many matches. Of course, the Hell in the Cell one we'll go to in a little bit too. But it's because of Undertaker, he made Mick Foley that much better. So that's a huge part in The Undertaker's chapter of his career, going up against Mankind.
So, backstory for me.
Yeah.
So I used to read the PW Insider magazines, Pro Wrestling Illustrated, the Aftermags, yep, as they're renowned now. And so they had this advertisement for this newsletter, and it wasn't Meltzer's newsletter or any other newsletter. It was the Apter newsletter. So the first one that I got was before SummerSlam.
Okay.
And the headline on it was, "Is there dissension amongst Undertaker and Paul Bearer?" And I'm like, "What? Wait, what? What?"
Yeah.
So that was really one of the first times that I had something spoiled for me. Was because this newsletter that I subscribed to, because I was always looking for more wrestling information, had that headline. And then it happened at SummerSlam. I'm like, okay, got it. Yeah. I don't want to do these anymore.
Right.
And I remember when the subscription ran out, and I'm like, I'm done with these things. You know, fast forward to, I think it was the Montreal Screwjob, where I'm like, oh, I need more. I need more information on this stuff. And that's when I got hooked on Meltzer and
You went all in on him.
Stuff like that, yeah.
I'm like, the
better backstory than the on-screen stories.
Right, and those were the magazines you saw at CVS and Walgreens all the time in the newsstands. You know, just to rewind just briefly, you know, we talk about Mankind there, but and you touch on Yokozuna a little bit too. I like that was, for me, with that era of The Undertaker, you know, he became part of the All-Americans there, Survivor Series 93. And then in Boston, yes. And I just really felt like he had a good shot at beating Yokozuna at Royal Rumble 94. I just really had that, you know, I had my heart on my sleeve for him there as a fan, not knowing that he was injured, took some time off and everything. He wasn't even on that WrestleMania card. He was not on the WrestleMania 10 card right there. So I think you're right. He put Yokozuna over. He made him so much better. They worked. They loved each other. They're best friends outside the ring, too. So that was a huge thing to work together in the ring. And then he got him back at Survivor Series 94. But, you know, I put Yokozuna and Mankind right up there, top two, three of his rivals of all time for The Undertaker in his storied career.
You know, and I say I look beyond the Yokozuna thing because in the time, like, youngster me is like, oh, Undertaker's never losing. And then he loses, and you look back as to, well, he lost for this reason or he lost for this reason, because that's the behind the stage thing. But he was never really, like, given a run as WWF champion.
Nope.
Because he didn't fit the profile of WWF champion to what we had. You know, there's a reason why Andre held the belt for 90 seconds or whatever it was, because they had a vision for what the champion, what the main franchise player of WWF is. And Undertaker did not fit that vision, but he fit the vision of, well, this is an attraction, in the same way that Andre was an attraction, in the same way that others later became the big, like, oh, look at this. This is cool. And so that's what The Undertaker was.
Mm-hmm.
So fast forward to WrestleMania 13, and his opponent is Sid, and Taker wins the WWF Championship for the second time. And this is a moment where it feels like Vince McMahon is saying, break glass because we need Undertaker as the top guy. And I say that because at this time, it's chaos. Shawn wins the title from Sid at the Rumble. Austin wins the Rumble match in a questionable fashion. One of my favorite Rumbles is the 97 Rumble with the finish and all that stuff. It's an
excellent that was awesome.
Rumble.
Yep.
Then Raw, then Thursday in Lowell. Mm-hmm. Shawn Michaels loses his smile, hands the title back to Vince because supposedly Shawn doesn't want to lose to Bret. But there's actually a dispute as to whether Shawn versus Bret was going to be the WrestleMania 13 main event. So Bret wins the vacant title at WWF Final Four, beating Austin, Vader, Taker, who were the final four combatants in the 97 Rumble. Excellent match, by the way, if you want to go back and watch that one. Then the next night on Raw, Bret loses the title to Sid.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got four guys who are all vying for the WWF title because Shawn Michaels has handed it over.
Yep.
So Bret Hart and Steve Austin break off and have one of the greatest matches in WWF history. Yep. And Sid is now defending and losing the WWF title to The Undertaker at WrestleMania 13. And so I go back to what Dave Meltzer wrote at the time, and there's a reason why I want to bring this up.
Yeah.
So Meltzer wrote, quote, match ended with Hart and Undertaker glaring at each other. They've done an incredible job this year destroying the credibility of the WWF Championship with all the run-ins and screw jobs in every title match, which probably explains why the title matches mean so little in TV ratings. So I point this out from his observation because I disagree with it.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, in this era, with as hot as Nitro was and Raw was becoming, ratings be damned, this was an idea. This was an ideal time to go into WrestleMania with a hot potato of a championship because nobody knows what's going to happen next.
Right.
Which is what makes wrestling so great. We sit there today and we go, well, Drew McIntyre's not losing to Bobby Lashley. He's not losing to Dolph Ziggler. He's not losing to this person. Brock Lesnar isn't losing to Ricochet because it's all predictable. There's a sense of predictability there. At this time, you didn't know what was going to happen. Steve Austin wins the Rumble out of nowhere, and and it's in Texas, and you knew Shawn was going to get the title back.
Yeah.
You knew Shawn was going to get the title back from Sid at that Royal Rumble, but you didn't know Shawn Michaels was going to walk into the Lowell Memorial Auditorium and hand the belt over.
No.
And then it became, well, okay, so they got four guys in this match. Who's going to win? Bret wins and then loses the next night.
Right.
And then this is what makes wrestling great is the Raw before WrestleMania, where you have WrestleMania set up as Steve Austin versus Bret Hart and Undertaker versus Sid. There's a Bret Hart Sid steel cage match for the WWF title. And so now Austin and Taker are trying to help their respective WrestleMania opponents try and win the championship.
Yep.
This was great TV. And then Bret cuts the promo where he loses his mind and it starts the Bret Hart villain turn. So this was just a great time of chaos. And circling it back to The Undertaker.
Yep.
WrestleMania 13, you need some stability with the championship after all of that chaos. So you go to The Undertaker. And The Undertaker's run was Farouk, Ahmed Johnson, and then to Bret Hart at SummerSlam.
Mankind.
I'm sure Mankind had a title fight in there at some point. Oh, yes, that's right.
Yeah,
He did. So, Mankind could have won the WWF Championship in that slot. I didn't think Farouk was.
Absolutely.
I didn't think Ahmed Johnson was. Ahmed Johnson didn't even make that show.
Nope, he did not. And that was a crazy time. So,
but that was such an exciting time. And then Undertaker wins the title at the 13th WrestleMania, which works with his dark side character. Not a great match, but again, the Undertaker worked a different pace. So that's why early in his career, there were these slow, methodical matches. And it was also a different time in wrestling where it was more character based, and you weren't always getting these 5-star Tokyo Dome matches.
Character based, and also too, like, you kind of knew he was a heavy favorite to win that match against Sid for all the reasons you stated there and everything and the backstory and so forth. But WrestleMania at that time, Jimmy, that's where the babyface always won to close out the show, right? You know, you go back to WrestleMania 12. It was Shawn. I mean, even though there were two babyfaces, Shawn with this moment there. WrestleMania 11, LT against Bam Bam Bigelow. WrestleMania 10, you know, Bret Hart. 9, Hulk Hogan. So obviously, it was right in that era there where the babyface always had that WrestleMania moment at the very end, and pretty much that's how it is. So he won there. Now, personally, I'll say this. I prefer, it's always cool to see your favorite wrestler to be at the top of the food chain there and a champion. I had no issue with The Undertaker not ever being a champion, because you know that whenever you are a champion, just like in anything in sports, everyone is coming to, you know, you're the top gun. Everyone is going after you. They play up and all that stuff. So the pressure, I thought, was on the Taker. So when he won at WrestleMania 13, I'm saying in the back of my mind, oh, no, here we go. Just like, again, as a fan, when is he going to lose? You know he's going to lose. He's not going to hold the title too much longer. It might be against Mankind. It might be against Farouk. But again, there at SummerSlam, like, there's no way he's going to beat Bret Hart. Or if he is to beat Bret Hart, something iffy is going to happen. And sure as heck enough, we know what happened there on that. But it just, like, I'm fine with his character being at that, you know, how he is displayed and told to us with all the mythical powers he has and everything, and his agility and his ability in the ring too. I'm fine with The Undertaker never being a champion. And even when he was a champion too, a little later down the line, it didn't really do much for me. Didn't do much. I'm fine with him not being a champion.
So just to go through the timeline of his defenses on pay-per-view, at least, it was Mick Foley.
Yep.
At the April In Your House. Revenge of the Taker. It was beating Steve Austin.
Yep.
At Cold Day in Hell. King of the Ring, he beat Farouk. And then the Canadian Stampede, as he tried to say, was a replacement. It was Vader for Ahmed Johnson. And then Undertaker loses to Bret Hart at SummerSlam Heart and Soul 1997. Shawn Michaels is the special guest referee. And all this is going on. And before we get to that, Paul Bearer is teasing Kane's coming.
Yep.
Kane's coming. Undertaker's little brother is coming. So you've got Taker as champion, who's also got in the back of his mind, he's got to worry about what's Paul Bearer have coming up his sleeve. And before we get to Kane, SummerSlam 97, that Bret Hart Undertaker match, about as good as it gets.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Yep.
Bret Hart wins his 5th and final WWF championship over Taker following a Shawn Michaels chair shot, which ultimately would move us to the Shawn Michaels Undertaker program, leading to the Hell in a Cell match, which is arguably the greatest Hell in a Cell match of all time. Mm-hmm. And Kane's debuting. So there's a lot here, right?
Yep.
Bret wins the title. Bret's doing the USA versus Canada thing. Bret's the champion, and he's underneath Undertaker and Shawn Michaels, which is interesting because it feels like Undertaker was the champion underneath Bret Hart all summer.
Mm-hmm.
So now you flipped the script.
Yep.
So what was interesting to me about the Undertaker Shawn Michaels program is it wasn't really done at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And working with Bret and Shawn, I think it started the transition of the Undertaker to having these higher quality matches, because Bret Hart is in ring. There are few performers who can top how he can put a match together psychology-wise.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way, Shawn Michaels is one of the great in-ring performers of all time. And Undertaker gave them a lot and a lot of things to work around. So these are two programs that make sense, and it all leads to Sean and Brett in Montreal. But before we get there, it's the Sean versus Taker Hell in a Cell match, which we had never seen anything like this before.
Nope.
Because it was the first time. And WWF was only doing it, I think, because Hulk Hogan and Rowdy Piper were doing an oversized cage match.
Mm-hmm.
So let's put together this structure. And I don't think anybody saw Shawn Michaels winning. And the way that that match went, there's no way Shawn Michaels was winning. And then here comes Kane.
Yeah.
One of Vince McMahon's great calls of all time. That's got to be Kane.
And yeah, and that was Vince's last ever broadcast as a commentator too. Hell in a Cell, 1997, right there in your house. That was it. He was done. He went to gorilla position after that. And so much. Yes, it was kind of like the Buried Alive match from the year before, where I think Taker was a heavy favorite in a match that was, you know, his gimmick. And he loses to Mankind. Disqualification. Well, there's no DQ there, but he has everyone, you know, gang up on him. And a casket match, too, 94. Loses to Yokozuna. And sure, here we are, Hell in a Cell. He loses that one, too. So it's like, what the hell? What do you want this guy to do? What do we need here to have The Undertaker win a match? A theme match, and he just can't do it. But you're right. That was the advent of Kane. That set up so many. Again, another great rival in the history of The Undertaker right there. He's number one in my book for the greatest rival of all time with The Undertaker. But
I think, Mike, what you have here is WWE doing some deep,
yep,
progressive booking and layering their stories with multiple characters involved in multiple things and continuing them.
And they did it so early, too, as you touched on there. SummerSlam 97, that time frame, Paul Bearer is teasing that Kane is coming. And it's, yep, like, who is this guy he's talking about? Who is he? So the fact
and that it's an evil dentist.
Right, exactly. And and you know, you hear him talk about it for 2 months, and brilliant for ratings, brilliant storytelling. Who the hell is Kane? Who is this guy, you know, with the Undertaker's mother's house, that funeral parlor burned down and so forth? Awesome, really good stuff. And here he is, this larger than
the greatest life story that Bruce Pritchard has ever written is the Kane Undertaker story.
Named his kid Kane. He named his child Kane because of that. He loves it. It's his favorite character of all time, he said. That
of course, like, he created it.
I mean, but how can you not be?
So Kane interferes, and yep, now you've got essentially Undertaker 2, because Kane has the similar. He's got similar but opposite things of the Undertaker. He, yep, does the fire. Undertaker does the darkness, right?
Yep.
So it all leads to Undertaker, I'm not fighting my brother. I'm not fighting my brother. And then Kane gets him to the point where, well, he's got to.
Yep.
So that's WrestleMania 14. And again, this is a hell of a match. And
awesome.
The finish to the match is three tombstones. And Kane kicking out of the third one at 3.5 or
right,
3.25. And this is after Undertaker hooks the leg,
yep,
which is something that we hadn't seen before.
Yep.
Like, you were at WrestleMania 14 in Boston.
Yep.
Detail it for us, being there.
It didn't. You're right. Obviously, when the Taker does a tombstone, that's pretty much it. But to go three on them there, and then the pin, that was kind of like a tease of him getting out of this. I don't know. It was still a little ways out, but it was the big, you know, some, I guess you could say, some seeds are like, oh boy, maybe this is no longer the real dead man character. He's got a little vengeance on him here to be going after Kane, and like, wow, he actually might lose this match. Kane actually may win the match. And yes, Taker did win, but it kind of felt like a loss afterwards, because Paul Bearer comes out and he has Kane beat him up with the chair there at the end and so forth. And, you know, Kane ended up walking out. They have the rematch a month later. But everyone was on their feet for it there. Taker with the high-flying maneuvers. Kane, you know, this is moments after he just tombstoned Pete Rose too. Everyone was like, wow, this guy is huge. He's a monster. So we really get to see him in the ring too and what he's able to do. Same stuff, copycat, if you will, of The Undertaker's maneuvers over the years, studying each other so well. But people were just obviously in awe of these two larger-than-life figures right there. But again, at the end, it didn't feel like a win for the Taker. You just knew more was to come.
Which led to a return match. Something called an Inferno match?
Mm-hmm.
Which we didn't know, but crappy match, but what a spectacle.
Awesome.
The flames around the ring, and then it's like, so...
Was this like so Attitude Era or what?
It was, but yeah. it's progressive stories. And, you know, with whoever was suggesting it, Vince Russo, Jim Cornette, Jim Ross, Bruce Pritchard, whoever wants to take credit, Vince is the ultimate editor. And so Vince gets the credit for approving the idea.
Yep.
Right? So the Inferno match, how do you win it? And it's you have to burn your opponent. Well, it kind of gives it away that Kane's losing because he's got the full bodysuit on. But that's okay because you're still looking, and I remember the visual of Undertaker doing the leap over the flames. And so that's a cool thing. So Undertaker gets another win over Kane. So now we fast forward from the Inferno match, which my thinking is there's only been like two or three of them in existence. And that's a quick Google here.
Yeah. Not I feel that like many. One with I can't
Kane
think of that many.
And Bray Wyatt.
Let me see here. So you have Undertaker Kane. It happened twice. Undertaker Kane.
There's a Triple H.
See that one there, the arm on fire. Yeah, that's what I'm looking at right now. Hand set on fire by Viscera Midian? What the hell is this one?
Oh, that's tremendous. That's a great Google search right there.
It's awesome. The second one, Kane's foot caught on fire. And that was 1999, it looked like. Here we go, 99, yeah. And it was on Raw. And then there was also, Triple H Kane on SmackDown, September of 99. Wow. Kane versus MVP. Armageddon. So four. That's what I got. Four right here.
No remembrance of that. But at the time, it was really cool. Really cool visual.
Yep.
So ultimately, the behind the scenes story is you're leading into King of the Ring 98. And Kane is in the world title picture against Steve Austin because WWF doesn't want to do three pay-per-views in a row or four pay-per-views in a row of Kane Undertaker or three pay-per-views in a row of Steve Austin versus some formation of Mick Foley, whether it be Dude Love or Mick Foley. But Mick Foley, after his run as Cactus Jack, becomes corporate Dude Love.
Yep.
And the ratings are starting to change, and the tide of momentum is swinging back in the WWF's favor. Mike Tyson had a lot to do with that around WrestleMania 14, too, because it was mainstream coverage and Austin and McMahon and all that stuff.
The end of 83 weeks.
But so in the main event of King of the Ring 98, Kane wins the world title from Steve Austin because Undertaker hits Austin with a chair, causing Austin to bleed in a first blood match. Again, a little bit of a predictable result because a first blood match, Kane has a mask on.
And two sleeves.
So a little hard to bleed there. And Austin's got this big bald head, right?
Yeah.
And if Kane loses, he's got to be doused in gasoline and set on fire.
Right.
So, Kane's winning the title. I don't know how, but they're not going to set a man on fire on pay-per-view. Although maybe they would have. Don't know.
Yep.
So that's kind of a less talked about detail about King of the Ring 1998.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the big detail is the Hell in a Cell match, which both Mick and Taker would say was a cold match.
Yep.
And Bruce Pritchard would say the match was put together because they didn't want to have multiple pay-per-views of the same matches, which is something they do now.
Right.
Undertaker fighting back. He's fighting back. They're out of bullets, folks. And I don't like it a damn bit. But they're all out here, really. I mean it. Well, we got our Spanish announce teamer down. We need doctors out here. If somebody can get off their butt in the back and get some people out here.
Look at Mankind is moving.
There's Terry Funk. Good God. Good God.
That's it, he's dead.
Will somebody stop the damn match? Enough's enough.
Just an unbelievable brawl, right? The Undertaker at one point is standing up on top of the cell and the crowd is chanting Undertaker.
Yeah.
So this is arguably the greatest call in wrestling history is Jim Ross yelling, good God almighty, they've killed him. They've broken him in half. Meltzer, for all of his bitching about the match, gave it 4.5 stars.
4.5 stars, huh?
Damn. Yeah, and at the time, 5 stars was the gold standard, like 8 in Japan or whatever.
Yeah.
But here's the point is that Undertaker and Mick Foley went into a cold match and made it one of the most memorable matches in history, and they both worked around injuries before and during the match.
Yep.
And this match, I feel like, made the Undertaker again, this dominant force.
You do, really?
Yeah, just...
Okay.
I remember very clearly the visual of the Undertaker standing on top of the cell, the crowd chanting Undertaker after he throws Foley off the table, and they're trying to lift the cage up so that they can get the stretcher around to get Mick out of there.
Well...
And it's just, it's such a great, like, it's such a great memory for me because it's like, yup, that's the friggin' Undertaker right there.
You know,
that's
yeah,
the guy right there.
No, that, you're right. That was a huge one. I'd have to say the victory over Kane. I mean, and again, with the Mania 14 at the end, it did feel like a little bit of a loss. It was a hard-fought victory. But then the Inferno match, it's just such a build-up to him right there. That felt like more of a dominant part for me right there. What I took out of the Foley, the Mankind Undertaker match in 98, yes, there was dominance, but again, going back to what I said with WrestleMania 14, with that vengeance of the Undertaker showing that mean side of him there with the pin, he had to pin Kane, you know, holding up his leg to try to, you know, have him, you know, 1, 2, 3. Never saw that before. That was a birth of what we're about to see for the Taker, and that's a more mean side we saw with him right there at King of the Ring. Foley gets thrown off the cage, done. Comes back up, throws him through the cage this time. What else do you want? Like, are you kidding me? Just walk away. He's done. That's it. I just thought we had more of a, like a real, kind of like a jackass Undertaker, if you will, like a jerk. Not a nice guy. I mean, listen, he's not the friendliest guy as a character, but this one here, no remorse. No remorse. And he really owned it right there and showed it in that best display he could with Foley. It was almost like a murder scene. I hate to use that term. It was really with the tacks and everything on him. It was like, what else are you going to do to him? It was like Crucifixion 2000. It was unbelievable.
And it was so that was really... It was one of the more aggressive matches in that company's history. And
yes,
it was different because it felt real because it was real. Like he threw him off a cage. He threw him off a cage and then he choke slammed him through a cage. And then the match continued.
Right.
And then the Undertaker obviously won the match, but like what a spectacle. And
awesome.
We all remember it. We all remember different parts. I'm sure that if you, there's always the question of like, if you go up to a non-wrestling fan and you say, tell me one thing about wrestling.
Yep.
It's usually like Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, or, hey, remember when that guy got thrown off the cage?
That's it. Yep. And for any wrestling, yeah. And for any wrestling fan, it's like where, you know where you were. You just know where you, if you were watching it live, you know exactly when time stopped, you know where you were, you know, just like that. So, yeah. And you know, to go back on that too, for that, the King of the Ring there, Jimmy, where Stone Cold Steve Austin lost to Kane again, here he is just beating the hell out of Mick Foley there, comes down, and what the hell is he doing in street clothes? Why is he coming in street clothes here to save his brother Kane, who he just had a couple of big feuds with? Well, he looked like he was about to save his brother Kane unintentionally. And then why is he going after Austin? What are we getting here? Are we trying to have a heel? So I had a little bit of confusion with The Undertaker at that point, where I thought he was supposed to be a babyface. Mankind was the heel, and now all of a sudden it was like a real turn here, where Taker comes down, interferes in the match, and Kane's a new champion just like that. What the hell's that about?
So around this time was the street clothes Undertaker promo, where he feels like he's underappreciated.
Some 10 years ago, when I first arrived in the World Wrestling Federation, Vince McMahon was known for somebody that would give somebody an opportunity, even if they were just a little different. And Vince McMahon did just that. He gave me the chance to be myself, to be The Undertaker. But you see, that's where all the giving stopped and all the taking began. Shortly after my arrival here in the World Wrestling Federation, I became the Slayer of the Dragons. Now you ask, what do I mean by that? Vince McMahon knew that I would be loyal for him giving me an opportunity. So what he did is he put every giant, every freak that he knew his hand-picked champions couldn't beat, and he sicked me on them. And I beat them, I destroyed them, and I moved on. What I did for Vince McMahon was make his kingdom safe for himself and all of his hand-picked champions. The whole time, I knew that my time would come. And after I made his kingdom safe and there was no one left, well, then I got my opportunities. Oh, yes, I am a two-time former World Wrestling Federation champion. But as you all know, my tenure as champion, they didn't last very long. Why? Because Vince McMahon didn't want someone like The Undertaker representing the World Wrestling Federation. But I remained loyal. Even after all his hand-chosen favorites left town for greener pastures, more money, I stayed here. I stayed by his side, thinking my time would come. How do I get repaid for that? He forces me to fight my own brother. He gives Paul Bearer an open forum to discuss every tragic incident that ever happened in the life of The Undertaker. For what reason? Let me tell you why. Because it's all ratings. He put my family tragedy on the line for ratings. And even after all that, I never lost my smile. I kept on fighting. And as I've been taking care of family business, Stone Cold Steve Austin, right to the top. Now don't get me wrong, I've got nothing against Steve Austin. The only thing Steve Austin ever did was come to the ring and fight me like a man, and that's all I ever asked. But you see, Vince, after years of mistreatment, and after the last 8 months of you throwing my family up in my face, I've had enough. Now it's time The Undertaker got what is rightfully his. I demand my shot at the World Wrestling Federation title. Now I've done enough talking. Now, Vince McMahon, Mr. McMahon, whatever it is you like to be called, I think it's time you got your pencil neck geek ass out here and faced the Reaper.
Which leads to, at the time, a good guy versus good guy match of SummerSlam 1998, the Highway to Hell. And this was a dud of a match. And I think it was a dud of a match because good guy versus good guy matches in the WWF realm, they don't do well. Hogan and Warrior was fine. I'm sure there are other examples. Like, I didn't like the Bret Hart Shawn Michaels match at WrestleMania 12. It's missing that element of emotion for the most part. I'm sure in more recent years, Shawn and Kurt Angle, I would call that a good guy match, but I was also older then. There might be different examples there.
Roman Undertaker, WrestleMania 33. I guess you could.
Dud of a match.
It was a dud. It was.
Dud of a match.
Yeah. Cena Undertaker 34.
I think Cena was more the villain in that.
Yeah, scenario. I guess in a way. He was ribbing him. Yeah. Yeah. I know.
But for what it was, and we'll talk a little bit more about this a little bit later on, but
yeah,
for what that match was, that was to establish the dominance of The Undertaker. And that was Cena's, as you saw in the documentary, no one was more happy to do that than John Cena.
Exactly. He was very pleased about that. Yeah.
But what that Highway to Hell match with Austin, as dud of a match was, is it led to Kane and Undertaker becoming a team.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll remember... they both beat Austin to get the world title off him, which led to Austin holding McMahon hostage
in the Bag 316
where McMahon peed his pants.
Tremendous
moment. Awesome. And it leads to the tournament. It leads to the Deadly Games tournament where The Rock becomes the WWF champion. But it leads to Undertaker and Kane being a team and having the Brothers of Destruction.
Yep.
Right? Under the guidance of Vince McMahon until eventually there's a turn there.
Yep.
So I want to jump ahead because I feel like that the next big jump in Undertaker, as far as his character goes, was the return in May of 2000. And that was Judgment Day,
mm-hmm.
where Undertaker's character made the transition to the American Badass. And he returned towards the end of the Iron Man match between Triple H and The Rock. He took out all the members of the McMahon-Helmsley faction. And I think a lot of people remember because it was the Kid Rock song and it was just different.
Yep.
And it was a massive adjustment for the Undertaker character. So, Mike, what'd you think about it when it happened?
Well, it was a chaotic match there. And then you hear this countdown with the two little girls. He's here. And then, with the bell, it's like, oh, wow, there's no real suspense there that this is the Undertaker, because they just gave it away with the bell. So it's like, oh my God, here he comes. But what's it going to be? And sure as heck enough, with the bike coming out And oh my God, there he is, Undertaker. JR sold it well. Jerry Lawler, you know, sold it so good there on the commentary. And it was like this guy, he was huge too, massive. His chest was totally ripped. Phenomenal shape of the Undertaker. It was an interesting, because he did talk about this in the documentary, The Last Ride, that he needed to reinvent his character in that Attitude Era. And he was right, because there were so many people that had that edge. And you weren't going to have that as a dead man character, where you needed to be more of the, you know, here he is, perfect example, the badass, American badass right there. So I liked it. I liked it for the time being. I think they extended a little too longer than they should have. I think they could have gone back to the dead man a little earlier than, you know, WrestleMania 20, when he was officially kind of brought back at that point there. But I think it was, change is good. Change can be a good thing. And I think this was a perfect time in the Taker's career, because that Ministry of Darkness, he was coming off of that not too long before, and he was a champion a year before that too. That was kind of, didn't do much for me.
That's why I skipped ahead.
Yeah. Good job. Yes, exactly. You know, so I think that was good. That really brought him back to that prominent level of main event status, potential champion, where he could be a champion again. I liked it at the time.
Mike, we didn't need to talk about him teaming with the Big Show and Chris Jericho coming out and talking about how he just put the audience to sleep for 20 minutes talking about, you know, the Big Slow and some desert and all that.
And nearly crucified Stone Cold Steve Austin.
It was a symbol. It's a symbol, yes. Pal.
Yep.
So he's back. He's on a bike, and the character is different. But I want to fast forward to WrestleMania 17, when The Undertaker went on to defeat Triple H. And I think it was at that point where The Undertaker's unbeaten streak was at 9-0, and they kind of realized it. Because I think initially Hunter was supposed to win that match, which of course he was.
Oh, yeah.
But at this point, the streak is Jimmy Snuka, Jake Roberts, Giant Gonzalez, King Kong Bundy, Diesel, Sid, Kane, the Big Boss Man, Hell in a Cell, and now it's Triple H. So there are some good names on that. There are some names on that list.
No.
But the streak is becoming a thing. And so that was an excellent match in Houston at WrestleMania 17, one of the best WrestleManias ever. The next year, WrestleMania 18, yep, Ric Flair and Undertaker is a marquee match that's put together at the last minute because neither one of them have opponents. And Undertaker wants to work with Ric Flair. And that moment, that Undertaker doing that for Ric Flair is when Ric got his confidence back, because he didn't have any confidence at the time. That match at WrestleMania 18, most notably for me, is the Arn Anderson spine buster out of nowhere.
Right.
Which was great camera angle. Nobody saw it coming, all that stuff. But this is Undertaker beating the hell out of Ric Flair for 20 minutes, 15 minutes, whatever the match time was.
Mm-hmm.
Then you fast forward to when Undertaker goes 11-0, it's beating A-Train and the Big Show. And it was almost on the pre-show of WrestleMania 19.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing? Where Undertaker at 11, you know, he goes to 11-0, is in a tag team match with Nathan Jones, where they eventually drop Nathan Jones, and he's beating A-Train and Big Show. And it's insane to me to think about that, right?
Yeah.
And then you go to WrestleMania 20, it's 12-0, it's Kane, it's the return of the Dead Man and Paul Bearer. And then what I think is actually the first time that the streak is really like challenged is Randy Orton.
Mm-hmm.
He's the legend killer at this time. And he is openly challenging, trying to end the streak. And it may have been at this time where it's called the streak.
Mm-hmm.
Randy Orton, of course, fails in his attempt, but that's where the streak, I think, got its name and got its marketing behind it and everything. So at this point, the streak means something, and this becomes what the Undertaker will be known for. Or at least this is really the on camera, the on screen starting point of that. Because this also starts, with the exception of one match, which is Mark Henry.
Mm-hmm.
This starts the run of Undertaker great matches at WrestleMania.
Yep. And that made him 13-0 right there, as you said, against Randy Orton. And, you know, those two had some really good feud. They had a good feud for a while. Taker, you know, he kind of took, again, I'll go back to the documentary here, listening to the words of Randy Orton in so many words, took him under his wing a little bit. You know, they got really close to each other on that European tour. He had his first, I think he had a SmackDown debut against The Undertaker in May of 2002, right around that time John Cena debuted against Kurt Angle, because, of course, Randy Orton and John Cena were part of that same class there, the Ohio Valley Wrestling, and Brock Lesnar, too. It just seemed like, yes, that is where so much prominence. Yes, the return of the dead man, the resurrection of him at Mania 20, Kane, that match wasn't that good, but it was the build-up there, and just to show that he was back, it gave that power with them right there. After a year of the 19 match, was like, oh, that's a dud match, and this really happened. But yes, it got much more serious here. 13-0, you're at double digits right there. Sure, he's missed a couple of WrestleManias in his career, but that's still a huge accomplishment and something for other wrestlers to strive for. And they made that streak so important for an audience to say, this is the guy right here. He's the king of WrestleMania. You want to try to knock down the streak? This is what we all have to set the bar for. And if you're going to do it, that's a guy to take it to take down right here. And the fact that he went 13-0 against a guy like Randy Orton with the legend killer status, that was a huge victory for The Undertaker. Huge.
And it became, with the exception of the Mark Henry match, which...
Yep.
There was talk, according to Bruce, that Mark Henry was going to beat the streak.
In the casket match, yep.
Which, wow.
Yeah, imagine and that.
Mark Henry would go on to be a Hall of Fame talent for WWF, but I don't remember at the time Mark Henry being a credible threat to being like, this is the guy who gets the streak.
Right, right.
And but after Mark Henry, it's Batista, Edge, mm-hmm. Michaels, Hunter, CM Punk, and that gets us to 21-0. With the exception of the Triple H Atlanta match, these are all great matches.
You Batista, hated that Atlanta match. You hated
oh
that
my
one.
Oh, God, I hated that match.
I hated that match so much.
I
know we talked about that, but it really had me on the edge of my seat the whole time. It just, again, there it is, streak. They built it up. And for one guy that could knock him off, here he is right here, Triple H. That's really – it just had me on the edge of my seat. I wasn't a big fan of the match. Thought it was okay. But it just really – oh, nervous wreck the whole time. Nervous wreck, Jimmy. Couldn't do it.
I hated that match because I felt like going into it, I'm like, of course Hunter's going to beat the streak, right? Hunter's right. Got to get his WrestleMania 17 win back, and he's going to beat the streak.
Yep.
And so Undertaker is carted out.
Yeah.
He wins the match and then is carted out.
That felt like a loss. It felt like a loss.
So Hunter does business, but Undertaker is carted out. Come on.
Yeah. It was come weird. On. And he also, that was the Johnny Cash theme song too. It didn't really feel like, you know, the traditional Undertaker. And listen, that's a great song by Johnny Cash, don't get me wrong. But that's not the Undertaker. We don't know him as that with that song there. I want, you know, the gong. I want all that. Or if you're going to go back to the American Badass one, give me the American Badass theme. I don't want Johnny Cash's theme for the Undertaker. Too sad.
And also with that, Mike, that Atlanta WrestleMania was terrible.
It wasn't that good. No.
The best match on that show was CM Punk versus Randy Orton.
Mm-hmm.
But that entire WrestleMania was terrible. And because we talked about Tuesday in Texas and how WWE was using Survivor Series and experiment to get a bounce back pay-per-view, Atlanta was to build for Roxina in Miami at WrestleMania 28.
Right.
Which it wasn't meant because Miz won that main event. People forget Miz and his one run with the WWF championship. He won a WrestleMania.
Yeah, he did.
He walked in as champion. He walked out as champion, which that's an accomplishment of itself. And Miz should get another run with the title. Maybe he doesn't want to, maybe he doesn't need it, whatever. But that WrestleMania match with Triple H was terrible.
Yeah.
Just awful.
It was a submission too. It was the Hell's Gate, if you remember.
Yeah, it was like the weakest tap out of all time by
Yeah. Well, they made up for it a year later. We know that.
Which was great.
And you were there for that.
That Miami match is there's an argument for it in my mind that that's the greatest match that I've ever seen live.
That's a good one.
It's top five. It might be top three. It might be one,
wow,
depending on what day you're asking me. But that match in Miami was an hour adrenaline rush.
Yep.
And I'll never forget the spot that I thought the streak was over. And that was Shawn super kicks Undertaker into a pedigree. And Shawn has to count because he's the referee in Hell in a Cell. And it's an Undertaker kick out. And I'm like, if you're not ending the streak on that one, then the streak's not ending.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And, but just that match was an adrenaline rush from the intros to the finish, to the hug at the end.
Yep.
And Jim Ross was on the call of it.
Yep.
Just everything lined up. The stars aligned perfectly for that match. And that was 20-0. And it was awesome.
Right. Huge one. And Triple H and Shawn, everyone knows their friendship. And the odds were against the Taker in that. They were against the Undertaker in that one. Big time.
Yeah, of course. And they should have been, right? Because if you want to play into the story that they did in Atlanta, Hunter barely loses that match.
Mm-hmm.
So now Hunter's got to come back and stack the odds against Taker. So it logically makes sense. And Hunter can't beat Taker, even with Shawn as the referee and all the plunder and everything. So, but I don't want to overlook the greatness of the Edge main event in Orlando.
Mm. Yep.
That was the WrestleMania Ric Flair retired. Undertaker and Edge main event that show.
People forget that too.
And the two Shawn Michaels matches at WrestleMania.
Yep.
The first one went on in the middle of the show and nobody could top it after that.
Yep.
And then the other one, it main evented Phoenix, which WrestleMania in Phoenix, like, yeah. but there are people who consider those two matches the greatest wrestling matches of all time, the greatest WWF matches of all time.
Yep.
They're awesome. They're unbelievably awesome matches.
Yep.
JR Jim Ross in his book, Under the Black Hat, tells an interesting story about the Arizona one. I won't spoil it here, but you got to go buy the book.
Okay.
Or, you know, the readable version of the book or the audio book. I like the audio book because it's
you have gotten the audio.
JR telling his own story is great. I've done that for both books.
I got to pick up on that.
I do have the paperback. The hardcover paper versions.
Yeah, no, I got to get the audio one too. Check it out.
But that's awesome. So that's where the line from Batista, Edge, to Michaels, to Triple H, and then the CM Punk one.
Yep.
And this is in the time that Paul Bearer passes away.
Right.
And CM Punk is coming off his run of 434 days as WWF champion, WWE champion.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's trying everything within his power to be booed for this match. And Punk's just at the end. He's burnt out. He's tired. And CM Punk saved that WrestleMania because he, in his own words, he had a death wish.
Yep.
And he was going to do everything possible to have the match of the night. And so Undertaker and CM Punk had a great match at that New York WrestleMania. I would say that was the best match on the show.
Yep.
So now the streak's at 21-0. And you're like, who's next for the streak? And here comes Brock Lesnar, a part-timer. And Brock Lesnar comes into WrestleMania 30 and beats the streak, Mike. He's the one who beat it. And it also, it might have been the worst match on the WrestleMania show. I remember sitting in a room with a group of friends. We're futzing around with our phone. We're like, this match is terrible. And then I think my friend Amir says, that's a third F5. And we all kind of like leaned forward, and there's a three count. And Amir, myself, Paul, there might have been a few other people in the room were like, what did we just see?
Yeah, just shocked.
What did we just see? We just saw, no, that had to be a mistake. They're not playing music. Like, and Heyman's doing the great sell job of like, you won, you beat the streak. Yep. And we're all just like, what just happened?
Yeah, the oh my God. Yeah.
So Mike, what was your reaction when Brock beat the streak?
So I was with a great friend of the show, Bill Neville. I was at his house. And I know you were kind of playing with your phone and everything. We were heavily invested in that match. Heavily invested. And again, all because of the streak buildup. 21-0 going into it. That match the year before with CM Punk was awesome. On the edge of your seat on that. Good storytelling with the Paul Bearer scenario. And here it is right here. No way Taker's going to lose. There's no way. It's 21-0. You got to make him 22-0. Part-timer, Brock Lesnar, you're right. It's like, are you kidding me? How can this guy come in and take down the greatest WrestleMania performer of all time? Huge odds in favor of The Undertaker right there, watching it back and forth. The F5 after F5. That's two. Another F5. Three. Another F5. Four. The fifth one seals the deal. It was on the edge of my seat. Major shock and disappointment. We just looked at each other like, what you said, did that just happen? Like, this is going to be a mistake. And yeah, referees screwed it up. They're going to go back. They're going to ring the bell. They're going to start the match over. No, that was it. The streak was over the way Michael Cole described it. The streak is over. That was it. Boom. Wow. Absolute shock. I just wanted to turn off WrestleMania after that there because I had no desire to watch the rest of that show. That was the third to last match of that WrestleMania 30 card in New Orleans. And the match went for 25 minutes to the Brock Lesnar Undertaker one. After that, you had a 6-woman tag match for the Divas Championship.
Or did AJ Lee retain?
Yes, she did. Yep.
Nice.
She won, yeah. Which was, again, a short 6-minute match. Thank God at the end, Daniel Bryan had his WrestleMania moment. Otherwise, I think a lot of people would have been very upset with that WrestleMania card there. So that was an absolute shock right there. Furious. And for Brock Lesnar's credit right there, he made himself a larger than life name. Not that he wasn't a real big guy, big deal, but this has propelled him to that next level. And that was a huge deal for to beat The Undertaker and the streak. Never been happened, never done before.
So Vince McMahon was on Steve Austin's podcast. He had some things to say about it. And then Paul Heyman threw out a conspiracy theory about the whole scenario of Brock Lesnar just taking the streak.
I remember being down in New Orleans there at number 30. And I was watching the match in the truck with Kevin Dunn and beer in each hand. And this was a match that I had to watch. I got two badass competitors in the ring and Brock Lesnar and Undertaker, and I had to see the finish. All of a sudden, man, I'm watching that referee hits a three count after that third F5, whatever it's called, and I couldn't believe my eyes. I was like that guy in the front row. His eyes got this big. I was true. That guy in the truck.
Right.
I said, holy smokes, what just happened?
Right.
How, when, and why was the decision made to end the streak?
Well, no one wants to give back to the business more than The Undertaker, more than Mark Calloway. And he knew it's important to give back to the business. There comes a time in which it's time to do that. So why not then, when you consider, okay, who else was looking down the line, when you look at a talent roster, who else possibly could Undertaker work with and at that time give back in the biggest possible way he could to help someone be a star? When you look at that talent roster, you know, who was it going to be? There was no one on the roster, potentially, You know, in the following year, or the year after that, it was timing. And the one person whose time was there at that moment, who Mark thought, okay, this is it, that'd be Brock.
Come on, dude. You can't tell me Undertaker made that decision.
I made that decision.
Okay, you made the decision. Okay, absolutely. I thought you were saying he was serving himself up.
No.
You're giving a story about, okay, guy's been around a long time. He's
and no one wants to give back more than the Undertaker, right?
No.
I think you'd agree with that. He's one of the most unselfish people in the ring.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah, okay.
But that had to come to a shocker as him.
I think it did. You know, I think there's no question. It was a shock to everybody. That's on me. You know, those are decisions.
No, I'm not saying it was wrong. I'm just saying it was a surprise.
Those decisions, you know, aren't easy to make. You know, but you have to make difficult decisions sometimes. You know, that's my job to do that, and I think I made the right call at the right time. Coming into this year's WrestleMania, I don't think Brock Lesnar could be any hotter than he will be, reminding everyone of what happened of Brock Lesnar breaking the Undertaker streak. So to me, it was the right call.
Vince didn't really answer the question. There's only a very select people that understand what happened that night. The referee's not one of them. The music guy is not one of them. Vince McMahon is one of them. The Undertaker, who collapsed behind, and that's a shoot, collapsed behind the curtain, was taken to the hospital for a shoot. Vince McMahon left WrestleMania before Daniel Bryan was crowned champion because the Undertaker was taken out in an ambulance, and we didn't know how bad of a situation we were facing. Undertaker knows what happened that night. I know what happened that night. Brock Lesnar knows what happened that night. Now, here's the funny question. If so few people know, why would we ever open up the secret of what happened? So let me plant a little doubt in your minds where you sit there and say, is Heyman telling us something we're not supposed to know, or is he just fucking with our heads? So let me ask you this. How do you know it was a creative process? How do you know that was supposed to happen? How do you know? You may think you know, but do you know? You know? What would have happened at WrestleMania 30 if Brock Lesnar said, fuck it, I'm taking it on him. I'm going to dump him on his head. I'm going to knock him out. Then I'm going to F5 him. I'm going to hook his leg. And I'm going to pin him for real. And nobody's going to be able to fire me. Because once I beat that streak, how could they fire me? Now, ask yourself this question. I always joke around and I say, work or shoot, the finish is the same. Because when it comes to Brock Lesnar, work or shoot, the finish is usually the same. So let's say that was Brock Lesnar's mindset that night. Let's say Brock Lesnar said, I don't want to lose. I'm going to win. And they can't do anything about it because they can't fire me if I just beat the streak because I'm the guy everybody's going to talk about. Do you think he can't do it? Do you think The Undertaker would be able to stop Brock Lesnar from taking that victory? Could anybody in WWE stop Brock Lesnar from taking that victory? And what if, this is not the ant with the balls if, this is a true question, what if that's what happened? What would the reaction be? Wouldn't the reaction be exactly what it was, that The Undertaker needed a year just to get his head back into the game? Because he wasn't that badly injured. He went home the next day. He was hurt. He was hospitalized. But he went home the next day. He didn't need a year off. But he took it. Why? Yeah. This is like the Kennedy assassination. There's a lot of conspiracy theories. But the one that I'm offering has never been offered in public before. So I'll say it for the fourth time of the evening. Brock Lesnar does what Brock Lesnar wants to do. And what if on that night, in front of the whole world, live, on the first WrestleMania offered on the network, what if Brock Lesnar decided, I'm going to do what I want to do? What if he really did conquer the streak? What I love most about working with Brock Lesnar is that if I presented this to you about anybody else on that roster, you'd point at me and go, bullshit. But the fact that I presented to you about Brock Lesnar, I guarantee you at least half of you will go home tonight saying, did he just fucking tell us something that we're not supposed to know? Maybe I am, maybe I'm not. But it's certainly worthy of a conspiracy theory, isn't it?
Dave Meltzer in the Wrestling Observer wrote in his description of the match, quote, when Brock Lesnar hit the F5 for the third time, referee Chad Patton, who knew the same finish that everybody else thought they knew, hit the mat once, hit the mat twice, and then didn't know what to do. He was told Undertaker was winning, but the rule every referee is told that if guys don't kick out, you continue the count.
Yep.
The Undertaker wasn't kicking out. There was slight hesitation, which is why people were confused, because he was confused, but he did his job. It was at this point that time stood still, while Lesnar whispered in Undertaker's ear, thank you. It was a once-in-a-lifetime, at least for this streak. So, I don't know how Meltzer would know that Brock whispered thank you in Undertaker's ear, because there would only be three people who would know that, maybe four. The Someone referee, told. Chad Patton, Paul Heyman,
yeah.
Undertaker, and Brock Lesnar. So, yeah. I mean, it's Chad Patton, the stooge to Meltzer. Who knows?
Yeah. Was he reading lips?
But I don't remember there being a hesitation.
No.
I mean, I have to go back and watch it, but it seemed like a pretty fluid count.
Nah, there was. He was like, "Wait a minute, one." It was slow. It was a little slow, from what I remember. And he was even like, "Damn, am I going to do this? Am I going to end the streak as the official?" You could kind of see the reaction. There was some good theater in there. And again, everyone, I think, on the edge of their seat watching it, like, "Oh!" And it, boom, there it is. It's over.
Yep, there it is. The streak ends.
Yeah.
And Brock Lesnar, realistically, is it hindsight being 2020. At the time, you're like, they gave it to this guy, the part-time guy.
Yeah.
Like that doesn't help anybody. But you look at it and you say, Brock's the guy who can handle it.
Yeah.
He's a businessman. He's a legitimate UFC fighter.
Yep.
So if you're going to do it, it's got to be him. And part of the reason why I say that is because there are only two people to tap out Undertaker unofficially, right? There's Brock Lesnar at that SummerSlam match.
Oh, yeah. 2015.
Yep, 2015. Yep. That was the false finish. And then there's Kurt Angle, who it happened in 02 in Boston. Taker's the Undisputed Champion. There's a pinning combination. Undertaker taps out on the three count, the match that they had to reshoot.
Right.
It was the same night that Edge and Hulk Hogan won the title. I think it was John Cena's second match in the company, in the main roster company, against Chris Jericho. And so if it's not Brock Lesnar, who is it that beats the streak?
Right.
Is it Kurt Angle? And that's a much bigger discussion. If it's not Brock Lesnar, Mike Riley, who is the one to beat the streak?
I mean, for a character standpoint and looking at that WrestleMania card, he wasn't even on it. Character standpoint, I'd probably go with, Kane. I think that would make the most sense. You know, that would be the guy. And if it didn't happen at that particular moment, it would have happened before Kane had his chances against Undertaker, the brother. I think that would be, or Mankind would also, years ago, but that ship had sailed. He had been retired by then.
But I, you know, even if they were to have been brought into a feud together, maybe Randy Orton too. You know, here he is right there. He was in that main event with Daniel Bryan. You could throw that in there. And then the other easy one would be because they fought, you know, the last two, 3 years, yeah, two in a row, Triple H. I'd say Triple H, Kane, Randy Orton. Those would be the three guys if you're not going to go with Brock Lesnar to end the streak at WrestleMania 30, if you're not going that route. Again, Kane not on the the card, but find a way to get him back into the storyline for that one.
So I think at the time the assumption was, well, Taker beats Brock, and then they'll find the young guy to beat the streak and get the Undertaker. Next year at WrestleMania 31, Bray Wyatt is the opponent in what on paper is like this dream match, this great match. And you think, okay, well, Bray Wyatt's going to win.
Yep.
Right. And then he doesn't.
Yep.
And then you go to Shane McMahon in Dallas, which was the first Undertaker retirement or the fourth Undertaker retirement or whatever, because he left his gloves in the ring in Dallas.
Right.
And then you get to Roman Reigns in Orlando. And we all know that this is the Undertaker's last go around because he's just physically beat up.
He's done. Toast.
And so, unfortunately, that match is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And we were there live. Ugh. We watched it. And we were part of the thank you Taker thing. And I'll never forget, like, they told us to go home at 12:16 Orlando time.
Yep.
And that's when everything was done. And you can see in the documentary, he's like, yeah, that's it. But he goes back and watches it. And it's like, that's not it. I can't leave on that note.
Yeah.
So now it's, how do you get in shape? How do you get ready? And then it's New Orleans and it's John Cena. And he prepares for 45 minutes, and he gets 10 with intro. Right. Because the intro was 7. So the match could have been more than probably 4 or 5.
Yeah.
John Cena being like, we're going to make you Undertaker.
And this Jimmy,
is what we're going to do.
2 minutes, 45 seconds.
And so Undertaker routs John Cena in New Orleans. And so now it's, is the Undertaker back for real, or is that the Undertaker send-off?
Right.
And it became, the Undertaker is now back, and now he's going to be on big shows and special events. So there are all these Saudi matches, and it's Undertaker, Triple H. Triple H has to win. It's Undertaker and Kane against Shawn Michaels and Triple H, which is one of the worst main events that they've ever done.
Awful.
So now you've got Undertaker chasing moments, right?
Yeah.
And it leads us to Goldberg and a match that we debated about where I'm like, this match is going to be so unique and so special and so interesting.
Yeah.
Or either on either side, it's either going to be a fabulous, just, you know, super moves and this, that, and the other thing, or it's going to be a car crash. And it was a car crash.
Major.
And it was because you had two older wrestlers who were trying to do all their stuff, and Bill Goldberg gets concussed, and Undertaker can't do this, and Goldberg can't do this. And so now you go from Cena in New Orleans to this with Goldberg. And it felt like that was going to be Taker's last match. And then there's the Extreme Rules match where it's, Undertaker says after he teams with Roman Reigns and they beat Drew McIntyre and Shane McMahon. And we both think, informed opinion, that Drew McIntyre and Undertaker were going to have a match at SummerSlam that year.
Yes.
But now what happens is Undertaker goes to Vince after that tag team match at Extreme Rules and goes, hey, I'm done. And so now, and Vince says to him, look, I'll follow your lead. But now the Drew McIntyre match is off the table. And now Undertaker's done. So now you've got what's next. Is Undertaker really done? And now that leads to AJ Styles picking at the Undertaker being like, I want to work with you.
Yeah.
And then it gets to the Boneyard match, which is one of the few things in WWF, I've been saying WWF for so long, in WWE that had a 98.5% approval rating.
Mm-hmm.
So now if you're The Undertaker, how do you not go out on that one? It's AJ Styles. It's approved by just about everybody.
Yep.
It's symbolic. He rides off on the motorcycle.
You get the best of both characters too, dead man and badass right there.
And it's the personal aspect of, oh, so the wife is involved.
Right.
Mark which is Calloway. Something that they hadn't really touched before.
Right.
So you've got all these three things, and it's just, it's the perfect send-off for that character. And it violates everything in wrestling where you're supposed to go out on your back. But you know what? It's The Undertaker.
Yeah.
And he deserves to win his last match.
It's like just one hellacious battle against one of the best in the business. Here you are, climbing on your motorcycle and taking off. There was a lot of thought, a lot of emotion that went through my head. One of those is being, are you happy enough with that? It was just a powerful moment. And you don't necessarily always get those. Man, if there was ever a perfect ending to a career, that right there is it. If Vince was in a pinch, would I come back? I guess time only tell there. Case of emergency, break glass, you pull out The Undertaker. I mean, I would have to consider that. Never say never, but at this point in my life and in my career, I have no desire to get back in the ring.
Is there somebody that Vince McMahon should break glass and open up The Undertaker for? And that leads to, it's two-part, multiple choice question as I'm facilitating here.
Yep.
Does beating The Undertaker still have value?
So here's the thing,
Mike. I gave you these questions at 6 o'clock today. Why? No, I'm kidding.
No. It's just there's so much to think to lay out here. The thing is that does it seem like yes with the Last Ride, the tribute, and really looking at that episode again today. I saw the final episode once again for the second time today. I took some notes on it. You got to remember that series was made before the height of the pandemic. And I think that if we had a crowd at WrestleMania, that would have been it for The Undertaker. Now, it seems like that this is it. You still haven't had an official word from him in so many words. Yeah, I'm going off in the sunset. But he kind of left the door open a little bit. You know, he didn't shut it the whole way. I think he's going to get something there for a larger audience down the line. I'm not ruling that out. So if that's the case, you're probably going to see it next year at WrestleMania. I know if everything in a perfect world, it probably would have been done this year in Dallas at Survivor Series where we're supposed to be. Again, that's a perfect world, but we're not in that in the year 2020. So I'm not ruling out a larger audience here. And a match for someone to beat The Undertaker, does it have value? It depends who you're going up against. It depends who you're going to have him fight, okay? If you have a guy like, you know, I'm just going to throw some names at it and spitball here. Kane, no, does no value. Mankind, no value there. But a guy on the roster like The Fiend, Bray Wyatt, I'd say so. But I think you'd need Taker to lose. You know, you look at other big guys, Braun Strowman. I think that has value right there. Drew McIntyre would be a great one. You know, the Ultimate Dream Match people have wanted for years. Sting, there's been talk about him coming out. You know, you could go back down the route there of Roman Reigns. But I think if you're going to have The Undertaker win his last match, if you're going to win one more match in front of a crowd, I think you got to do it against Brock Lesnar. I really do. He's the guy that ended the streak. Have Taker return the ultimate favor one more time. Undertaker, Brock Lesnar.
I just think that's the most, it makes most sense.
So I don't think that there's any value right now in beating The Undertaker again.
Yeah.
If I want to make the case that there is, it's Drew McIntyre, and it's for the WWE Championship, and it's Taker's last time. He has the opportunity to win the WWE Championship and retire as WWE Champion, and then you can open up to a bigger tournament, right?
Yep.
Because that I think is something that could have value, and you have Drew McIntyre win, but during the course of the match, Drew McIntyre has to turn into a villain. He has to cut every corner, because then you have this new character going forward as, okay, he was a good guy in front of no fans. So here he is in this championship fight against The Undertaker, and he's had this title for so long, and he wants to keep it, but it's The Undertaker, and it's Undertaker's one more match. And yep. So he's doing everything within his power to keep that title. And then McIntyre becomes a villain, and then you line up the baby faces and you extend the Drew McIntyre championship run with a different dimension to the character.
It's a good turn.
The Fiend Bray Wyatt might have some value in that he takes the powers from The Undertaker. The Sting match is something that we've all craved for.
Yep.
So that's on there, even though Sting is retired. The one that will irk wrestling fans so much, Baron Corbin.
Oh.
He's the bad guy that the fans don't know what to do with.
Yeah, yeah.
He's an old school true bad guy.
Yep.
He retired Kurt Angle. He's the king. He's doing this. He's the one true bad guy that fans don't know what to do with.
That would piss people off. That would piss me off big time if that's the guy. I'd be furious. Are you kidding me? Baron Corbin beat The Undertaker? No, 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 no. I mean, listen, great for storytelling, great for his character, but I would be furious, Jimmy. Furious. I'd find a way to get to Vince's office on that one. No.
Vince@WWECorp.com. So, Mike, you've made my point.
Yep.
But overall, I don't think that there is value, but I've just made the case for people that it might have value for.
No, that's fair.
I think Undertaker's last match was this past WrestleMania. I think that's what it should be. I do like Lance Storm put out a tweet, and this was his idea. At the next WrestleMania that you can have fans, The Undertaker is going into the Hall of Fame, which might be pushed back because
of everything that's going on.
We don't know what's going on, right?
Yeah.
But WrestleMania is scheduled for Los Angeles, and presumably that's going to be a huge WrestleMania and da-da-da-da-da.
Mm-hmm.
So the main event of WrestleMania isn't a match. It's The Undertaker doing his entrance, putting his stuff in the middle of the ring, and then you fade to black.
Kind of like Stone Cold Steve Austin at WrestleMania 25 when he said goodbye in that little RV, Rover is there, doing the beers and so forth. That could be it right there. He had his last match. That's it. And the fact that it had the Hollywood production, why try to fix something perfect or do something live in an audience where it was just picture perfect, if you will? You can add the capability to edit there. You don't have that in front of the crowd. So I like that with Lance Storm's idea. I do like that. But again, for me here, I'm just reading through everything. We've seen him come out of retirement. We know he's got a big contract with WWE, a long term.
15 years.
Yeah, that's a long time. So I'm not ruling out one more match in front of an audience, because I think that's what he may say, I owe it to them. And to his credit, at least 55. He is 55 years old, The Undertaker. It's 10 years away from senior citizenship. It's crazy, you know? So the fact that he got – watch that first episode, for those that haven't done it, of the Last Ride. Look at how out of shape he is coming down that plane for WrestleMania 33. He revamped himself there, and to resurrect his own little – you know, workout regimen and so forth,
he did it, and I know he would do it again for an audience there one last time, if that were to be the case. If not, I'm fine with the Boneyard match being over. I'd be fine with that. But if we are to get one more, give me a good opponent, and I think it would be a win, and it would be against Brock Lesnar.
So, Mike, any closing thoughts here on the career of The Undertaker before we get to what I'm calling a hidden gem match of the week?
Sure. This has been a lot of fun talking about The Undertaker here. You know, my favorite wrestler of all time. He had, you look at him with the gray when he came in the early 90s, and he had the purple in the mid 90s, a staple in the WWF when he could have jumped ship with his friends, Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, all those guys at the WCW, loyal to Vince. And, you know, as we discussed, was an attraction to a point. Had a good feud there with Yokozuna. Really, even that Undertaker versus Undertaker, SummerSlam 94, attraction right there. Did what he had to do to carry the torch for the company to the next guy. So many prominent parts in the Undertaker's career. Whether it be champion or not, he was at a very important stage in the WWE's history to either put the championship on someone else or put someone over. And what he did to make people get to that next level, that is why I think he is so respected in the locker room. And people look up to him as an icon. And just, he's that guy. He's been loyal. And the fact that he's done that and people can still go to him to say, hey, let's get some advice on the Taker. That's a pretty cool thing. I think Roman Reigns referred to him as the Godfather. He really is, when you think about it. Like, not the wrestler, the Godfather, but the Godfather, Don Corleone of pro wrestling. It's an honor.
So I think The Undertaker goes down in history as Vince McMahon's greatest creation.
Yep.
Longevity, the character, he was committed to being The Undertaker. He said in one of his many, many interviews that he protected that character, and it was only until really Orlando that he's like, you know what, let's let the cameras in. We're going to put my hair down, so to speak, and let people in. My kind of lasting, I never met him. I did not have that privilege.
No.
But I remember when we were in Dallas and we were in line for Bray Wyatt.
Oh, yeah.
And we were the 6 o'clock meet and greet session.
Yep.
For WWE Access.
Yep.
And The Undertaker's session was supposed to be 3 to 5. And we were in line to go to Bray Wyatt's, and he's still signing. Mm-hmm. And he is taking as much time as fans want. And I remember it being about an hour into the line. So think about that. His session starts at 3, goes beyond 5 o'clock. It's now 6 o'clock. So he's ending his session at 7 o'clock at night. And I promise you, every fan who did that meet and greet experience got what they had wanted. I remember looking at prices, trying to figure out how to get in there. And it's like $1,000 to meet The Undertaker. And I'm like, no way. I'm paying $1,000 to meet The Undertaker.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I like him, but it's $1,000. Like, come on.
Right. Man. Well, listen, I flew out of state to meet The Undertaker.
So, Mike, that's what I was going to say was you've met the man.
Yeah.
And you, I want you to share your story about traveling to The Undertaker meet and greet.
Yeah, that was South Carolina. I bought I got you an autograph. You got the 8x10. I had an urn signed by him, a replica one. I had two championship belts signed by him, one for myself, and Andy Wong got one as well. So I had a very heavy luggage on the way down to Charleston, South Carolina. But I made sure I got the VIP one, the upper echelon of having more items signed, and also to get in and out, because I just wanted to, I said, what the hell, if I'm making the trip, I'm going to go big or go home. So we did that and waited for about, 15 minutes as he arrived. Huge guy. This was 2018, December of 2018, Taker coming in. So just after the WrestleMania 34, not too long after that with John Cena, the squash match. And he's coming in and waiting in line. Finally get up to him. I'm like, oh, my God, there he is. I put my hand out before when we were able to shake hands at a period in life, you know. And, wow, just a monstrous hand. I'm wearing a Patriots hat. And he looks at it and he goes, I don't like your team, man. But I like, but I love Tom Brady. So this is at the time. So that was a really cool thing to say that right there. And got a picture with him. He signed everything for you and myself and Andy. And it was really an awesome experience right there. He had about 2 minutes with him. So it was really cool. But nice guy.
The experience, and he's a Dallas Cowboys honk.
Yes, which, he is.
Which now looking back, it makes sense as to why like he would have wanted to retire after the Dallas. Match with Shane McMahon in Dallas in the,
right.
in the Jerry Dome.
It's really, Taker's hometown right there, you know? So makes the most, and that's why I think, you know, Survivor Series this year would have been so, you know, memorable to him if it were to be in Dallas. But I don't think that's going to happen.
I will say this, though, in fairness, if Undertaker was my favorite wrestler of all time, and this was my one crack at meeting him, I would have spent $1,000.
Oh, absolutely.
I would have done it. 100% I would have done it.
I think I talked to you about that too at 32. I was like, Jimmy, do I do it?
And we did.
Yeah. And you were pretty honest. You were like, yeah, Mike, if he is, do it. And I'm like, I don't know. I just didn't want to do it at that time. But it worked out in the end. It all worked out in the end there. So, but yeah.
And I think especially now, like, you know, 2019, I went balls to the wall with everything, right?
Thank God we did, huh?
And now here we are. We're all locked down.
Right.
And we're not getting out of this until after the election at the earliest, right?
Right.
So, So, like, I especially now, like, looking back, I'm like, yeah, if there's an experience out there that you want to go do, like, you do it.
Do it, yeah.
Because and this is something that Jim Ross preaches a lot. Tomorrow is not guaranteed for any of us.
Nope.
And that's how it is. So, like, if you have the means and or the connections or whatever it is that you need, like, go do that experience. Have that joy in your life. So I'm glad that you got to meet the Undertaker. I'm glad you got to experience that.
And you know, Jimmy, just to to go on a personal thing, as I started at the beginning of the show, everyone, you know, my father just passed away. You know, thankfully we had some great times with him and everything. And he was a Brookline police officer for 33 years. And you know, every day coming home or going out there, rather, we didn't know if he was going to come home, but you pray to God he did. Put your life on the line for others. So you're right. You don't know. You just don't know. So live every day like it's your last right there. And, you know, if you really want that experience, just do it. Just do it. It may bite the bullet in the end. It'll be worth it.
Yep. So, as we wrap up here, we could do match of the week. And there's so many great Undertaker ones. But I kind of want to do a hidden gem Undertaker match.
Yeah, let's see it.
You look at, like, Undertaker Shawn Michaels, Undertaker Hell in a Cell, Undertaker Edge, you know, the Miami match we talked about, the King of the Ring with Mankind. Hidden gem Undertaker match. Undertaker versus Kurt Angle, No Way Out 2016. I'm sorry, 2006. That's one that you want to go back and watch. Undertaker and Kurt Angle had tremendous chemistry together. And it's somebody who, in the same way with the Bret Hart, Kurt Angle is a legitimate gold medalist, right? So he's got the technical stuff. Bret Hart's a legitimate grappler, submission wrestler, but Kurt Angle is like a shoot grappler submission guy. And I thought that this match at No Way Out was really a hidden gem Undertaker match that isn't talked about enough as being top-notch match. Mike, do you have one?
Yeah, you know, actually, that was a good one. I remember that very well. And then, again, those two have so much respect for each other, too. So when you know that the respect factor is right there, look back at it now, and they just went over the top on that.
it's actually the anniversary of it this past week, and I did the same route you did too with the Hidden Gem one. One that's not really talked about, but it was for the Undisputed title on an episode of Monday Night Raw, July 1, 2002. Undertaker versus Jeff Hardy, actually in Manchester, New Hampshire. This was the night before Undertaker fought Kurt Angle, and they had to redo that match there. But what a match, ladder match. And kind of like, you know, the WrestleMania streak matches there, like, oh my God, Jeff Hardy might actually beat The Undertaker and be the new WWE Undisputed Champion right there. It was back and forth. Unbelievable. He ended up getting the choke slam on Hardy at the end. But what was most memorable for me was he raised Jeff Hardy's hand at the end of it to show the respect right there. And Jim Ross even, you know, made mention to that. Look at the respect that The Undertaker gave Jeff Hardy. So check that one out. Raw of 2002, Jeff Hardy and The Undertaker ladder match, Undisputed title on the line.
So that match is the one where Jim Ross famously screams, "Make yourself famous."
Yes.
And this is after Jeff Hardy crushed Undertaker with a chair shot to the head.
Yep.
And Jeff is climbing the ladder and Jim Ross is screaming, "Make yourself famous.
Make yourself famous, kid." Yep. Awesome. And that was like right after that brand split, moment in time right there for Jeff Hardy to, you know, biggest moment of his career by far to beat the Taker and beat WWE champion. Are you kidding me? But what a moment, though. Really, what a moment right there for Jeff Hardy. And what a match, I should say. A good one. Check it out. Under the radar. Not talked about a lot, but check
Hidden
it out.
Hidden Gem. Hidden Gem.
Yeah. Yep.
Hidden Gem.
For sure.
Hopefully you hung with us for almost 2 hours. Each week you can listen to Wrestling Inside the Ropes on the podcast page of 985thesportshub.com and on the 985 The Sports Hub app. While you're there, check out all the other original podcasts available from Boston's Home for Sports. Our podcasts are also available at bpodstudios.com and in Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts. He is at Sarge985 on Twitter, Mike Riley. I am at I am James Stewart on Twitter. You can email the show, wrestlecast985@gmail.com. You can follow the show on Twitter at wrestlecast985. And we will talk to you next week.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.